What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School by Mark McCormack. An audio summary narrated for the AIIO Book Library. The subtitle is Notes from a Street Smart Executive, and it was published in 1984. It went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, sold in the millions, and it more or less created the genre of the practical business memoir. McCormack is worth knowing about because the book only makes sense in the light of what he did. He trained as a lawyer, and in 1960 he shook hands with a golfer named Arnold Palmer on a representation agreement. No contract, a handshake. Out of that he built IMG, the International Management Group, which became the dominant sports management company in the world. Representing Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Bjorn Borg, Jean-Claude Killy, and eventually events and institutions including Wimbledon. He also, and this matters for the book, did not go to Harvard Business School. The premise is in the title, and it is a genuine argument, not just a marketing hook. Business school, he says, teaches you the technical apparatus. Accounting, finance, marketing theory, the analysis of cases. What it cannot teach, and largely does not try to, is the thing business actually consists of, which is people. Reading them, persuading them, working with them, selling to them, and managing them. His name for the missing subject is applied people sense, and his claim is that it is learnable, that it is mostly observation and discipline rather than charisma, and that it beats the technical apparatus more often than anyone at a business school would like to admit. The book has three parts, and the shape tells you what McCormack thinks matters, and in what order. Part one is people. Reading them, creating impressions, taking the edge, and getting ahead. He puts this first deliberately, because everything else in the book depends on it. Part two is sales and negotiation. His view is that these are the same skill viewed from two angles, and that almost everyone in a company is doing one or the other, whether their job title says so or not. Part three is running a business. Starting one, building one, staying in one, and the mechanics of meetings, hiring, firing, and time. A word on the form. This is not a system. There is no framework, no acronym, no diagram, and no research. It is a working executive writing down what he has observed over 25 years, chapter by chapter, in short numbered observations. Some of them are a paragraph. That makes it easy to read and easy to dip into, and it also means it never has to defend anything, which the critique will come back to. The other thing to know is that it is written from inside a very particular business. Talent representation is relationship-driven, deal-based, and almost entirely dependent on personal trust. That is where the insight comes from, and it is also the source of its limits, the first section, and McCormack thinks it is the foundation of the rest. His central instruction is what he calls aggressive listening. Most people, he says, do not listen. They wait for their turn to speak, and while they are waiting, they are composing rather than receiving. Actual listening is an active, effortful thing, and it is rare enough that doing it well confers a real advantage. Alongside it, he puts aggressive observation. The information that matters about a person is mostly not in what they tell you. It is in how they behave when they are not performing. What they do with a waiter, whether they arrive on time, whether they return calls. What they choose to talk about when the formal part of the meeting is over. He is very good on the specific moments when people reveal themselves. They reveal themselves when they talk about themselves, which almost everyone will do at length if you let them, and which is why the fastest way to learn about someone is to ask a question and then genuinely shut up. They reveal themselves under mild pressure, not under crisis. Watching how someone handles a small inconvenience tells you more than watching them handle a disaster, because in a disaster, everyone is performing. They reveal themselves at the end. The moment the meeting is formally over, when people relax and are walking to the door, is when the useful sentence usually arrives. And they reveal themselves through their surroundings. McCormack pays attention to what a person has put on their office wall, because people display what they want to be known for, and what they want to be known for is a fact about them. His argument for why this matters is commercial rather than philosophical. If you know what someone actually wants, as opposed to what they have asked for, you can give it to them, and you will be the only person in the room who is able to. The other half of part one is the outward-facing version, managing the impression you make and the small accumulated advantages that come from doing it deliberately. McCormack's consistent advice, and it runs against instinct, is to underplay. Understate your position, your knowledge, and your enthusiasm. His reasoning is partly tactical, in that a person who is not visibly trying to impress you is harder to read and harder to resist, and partly practical, in that overselling yourself sets an expectation you then have to meet. He is unusually direct about modesty as a technique. Genuine modesty is disarming, and a small admission of ignorance or fallibility early in a relationship buys a great deal of credibility later. He is explicit that this works whether or not it is calculated, which is either refreshing or troubling depending on your temperament. On taking the edge, his point is about accumulation rather than any single move. Being slightly better prepared, arriving slightly earlier, knowing one more thing about the person across the table, being the one who follows up, none of these is decisive on its own, and the compounding of them over years is what separates people. Two specific tactics recur throughout the book and are worth naming. The first is silence. McCormack uses it constantly in reading people and in negotiation. Most people are uncomfortable with a pause and will fill it, and what they fill it with is usually information they had not intended to give you. His advice is simply to become comfortable with silence, which costs nothing and is difficult. The second is the value of being underestimated. He is quite happy to be the least impressive person in the room, because an opponent who has decided you are not a threat stops paying attention, and an opponent who is not paying attention is easy to deal with, the most practical material in the book, and the part that has aged best. McCormack is obsessive about organization and unapologetic about it. He worked from written lists on yellow legal pads continuously. Not as a productivity philosophy, but as a simple recognition that a person who reliably knows what they are supposed to be doing next will outproduce a more talented person who does not. His time discipline has several parts. Do the difficult thing first. Whatever you are avoiding will cost more the longer it sits, and the avoidance itself consumes attention all day. Protect blocks of time deliberately. The default state of an executive's day is to be consumed entirely by other people's requests. And if you do not defend time in advance, you will not have any. Use dead time. He was a relentless traveler and treated flights, waiting rooms, and cars as working time rather than lost time. Return every call. He is emphatic about this, and it is one of the places where his era shows and the underlying point survives. The reliability of your responses is a large part of your reputation, and most people are unreliable, so it is cheap to stand out. And then the chapter people most remember, which is learning to say no. McCormack's argument is that the inability to decline is the single most common cause of an overloaded and unproductive executive, that most people say yes to avoid a moment of discomfort and then pay for weeks, and that a clear early no is a kindness compared with a slow, hedged, eventual no. He also notes that saying no is a skill you can practice and that it gets easier. Underneath all of it is his view on delegation, which he treats as fundamentally a problem of trust rather than of technique. The difficulty is not deciding what to hand over, it is tolerating the fact that it will be done differently and, at least at first, worse. Cormack's starting claim is that everyone is in sales. The engineer explaining a design decision, the executive proposing a budget, the candidate in an interview, all of it is selling, and treating it as a specialist function performed by other people is a mistake. His picture of the good salesperson is not the one most people carry. It is not the smooth, fluent, fast-talking closer. That person, in his experience, sells less than the quiet one who asks questions and pays attention, because the fluent talker is broadcasting and the quiet one is gathering. The principles he keeps returning to are these. Sell the way the buyer wants to buy, not the way you like to sell. Some people want detail, some want the summary, some want to be left to decide, some want to be led. Reading, which is a direct application of part one. Ask for the order. He says, and this matches most sales research since, that a startling number of salespeople never actually ask. They present, they answer questions, they hope, and they leave. When you have the sale, stop selling. One of his most useful observations, and one people violate constantly. Continuing to make the case after the other person has decided reopens the decision, introduces doubts they had not had, and occasionally loses the deal. Take the long view. His whole business was built on relationships that ran for decades, and his position is that the best deal for the client and the best deal for you are usually the same deal, because you are going to be doing this again next year. And timing, he treats it as close to the most important variable in the book. Knowing when to make the call, when to press, when to leave it a week, and when to walk away is, in his account, a skill built from observation rather than a matter of luck. McCormack's approach to negotiation is not adversarial, though he is entirely comfortable with hard bargaining. It is informational. His first principle is that most negotiations are decided by preparation rather than by performance in the room. Know what you want, know what the other side wants, and above all, know their situation, their pressures, their deadlines, their alternatives, and who they actually have to satisfy. The person with the better picture of the other side's constraints wins most exchanges. Second, leverage comes from being genuinely willing to walk away, and it is not fakeable. He notes that a person who cannot walk will eventually be found out, and that the surest way to negotiate well is to arrange your position beforehand so that you do not need the deal. Third, never negotiate against yourself. If you have made an offer and received no response, the next move is theirs. Improving your own offer in the silence is, in his view, the most common unforced error there is. Fourth, concede slowly and get something in return for every concession, however small. A concession given freely is not read as generosity. It is read as evidence that there is more available. Fifth, do not fall in love with a deal. Emotional attachment to a particular outcome removes your ability to walk, which removes your leverage, which usually removes the outcome. And sixth, keep it simple. McCormack is wary of over-lawyered agreements, and he has a well-known skepticism about lawyers as deal participants, which is notable given that he was one. His concern is that complexity introduces delay, delay introduces doubt, and doubt kills deals that both parties wanted. Underneath it is his handshake with Arnold Palmer, which he returns to repeatedly as evidence that in a long relationship, the document matters much less than the judgment about the person. The third section is the mechanics, and it is the most conventional part of the book, though it contains several things people still quote. On starting, keep overheads low for longer than feels necessary. Understand that cash flow rather than profit is what kills companies, and be honest about whether you actually have a market or merely a good idea. On hiring, hire people better than you at their own job and accept the discomfort of it. He is blunt that the cost of a bad hire is much higher than most managers admit, because it includes the time you spend managing them, the effect on everyone else, and the delay in getting the right person. On firing, do it quickly and cleanly once you have decided. His observation, which most managers eventually confirm, is that nobody is genuinely surprised to be let go, and that the person who is dismissed usually knew before the manager did. On meetings, most are unnecessary, most run too long, and the fix is unglamorous. Have a reason, have an agenda, have a time limit and finish on it. Know what you want out of it before you go in. He also has a sharp view of committees, which he thinks exist largely to distribute responsibility until nobody has any. On growth, do not grow faster than you can manage, and be aware that the qualities that build a business are not the same as the qualities that run one at scale. On politics, corporate politics is real, pretending otherwise is naive, and the practical advice is to understand it, not to play it obsessively. And running through all of it is a theme about the personal touch, that as an organization gets larger, the small things that made it good in the first place, the returned call, the remembered detail, the note after a meeting, become both harder to sustain and more valuable because everyone else has stopped doing them, compressing the book to what has stuck. That business school teaches analysis and not people, and that people is what business consists of. That listening is a rare skill because most people are only waiting to speak, and that doing it properly is a durable advantage. That the useful information about a person comes from observation rather than from what they tell you, and particularly from the moments when they are not performing. That understatement beats overstatement, and that being underestimated is an asset rather than an insult. That silence is a tool in reading people and in negotiation, and that most people will fill a pause with something they did not mean to say. That everyone in an organization is in sales, whatever their title. That when you have the sale, you should stop selling, because continuing reopens a decision that had already been made. that most salespeople never actually ask for the order, that the ability to say no early and clearly is the difference between a productive executive and an overloaded one, that you should never negotiate against yourself, and that leverage comes from genuinely being able to walk away. That timing is close to the most important variable in any deal, and that the small reliabilities, returning the call, writing the note, remembering the detail, are cheap, are almost universally neglected, and compound over a career into something that looks from outside like charisma. This needs its own section, because it is the single most repeated claim attached to this book, and it is not true. The story goes like this. In a particular year, Harvard Business School, or sometimes Yale, surveyed its graduating class about goals. 3% had written goals down, 13% had goals but had not written them, 84% had none. 10 or 20 years later, the researchers went back and found the 13% were earning twice as much as the 84%, and the 3% with written goals were earning 10 times as much as everyone else combined. It is a wonderful story, and there is no evidence that any such study was ever conducted. Researchers have gone looking, repeatedly. Yale has stated that no such study exists in its records. No published paper has ever been found. The figures vary between tellings, the university changes, and the decade moves. It is worth raising here for two reasons. The first is that the story is very frequently attributed to this book by people repeating it, and that attribution circulates widely. The second is more useful. The reason the story spreads is exactly the reason a lot of business advice spreads. It is memorable. It flatters the reader, and it converts an ordinary sensible suggestion, write your goals down, into a precise and dramatic number. If a claim in any business book comes with a startlingly clean statistic and no citation, that is the moment to become interested in where it came from. Writing goals down is, for what it is worth, reasonably supported by actual research on goal setting, just not by that study. Reading a 1984 business book in the present requires some sorting, and it is worth doing explicitly. What has dated badly? The world of the book is telex machines, secretaries, expense account lunches, and an executive class that is almost entirely male, and the prose assumes it. The advice about travel, correspondence, and the mechanics of the office describes a working day that no longer exists. Some tactics that were an edge in 1984 are now simply table stakes. And a few, like the emphasis on physical presence and the long lunch, actively conflict with distributed work. What has become conventional wisdom, which is a compliment rather than a criticism? The claim that soft skills beat technical skills, that listening is the core competence, that everyone is in sales, and that business schools underweight people, were all mildly contrarian in 1984 and are now close to received opinion. That happened partly because of this book. And what still holds and is still neglected. Stop selling once you have the sale. Never negotiate against yourself. Say no early. Do the difficult thing first. Ask a question and then be quiet. Return the call. None of these are dated. None of them are technology dependent, and almost nobody does them consistently. The book has real limitations, and they are worth stating. It is entirely anecdote. There is no research in it, no evidence, and no counterexamples. Every principle is illustrated by a story in which the principle worked, told by the person it worked for. That is a very persuasive form and a very weak one, and the book never has to defend a single claim. It generalizes from an unusual business. Talent representation is relationship-driven, deal-based, high margin, and built on personal trust between a small number of people. McCormack's insights come from that world, and they transfer well to sales, consulting, agency work, and deal-making. They transfer much less well to running a factory, a hospital, or an engineering organization, where the binding constraints are process, systems, and scale, rather than personal rapport. There is a survivorship problem sitting underneath it. IMG's foundation was signing Arnold Palmer in 1960, at the precise moment that television was about to turn professional golf into a mass commercial spectacle. That was a genuinely brilliant call, and it was also extraordinarily well-timed. The book presents a career of skill, and the timing does more work than it is given credit for. The tactical framing sits awkwardly in places. Advice to deploy modesty because it is disarming, or to cultivate being underestimated, is instrumentally sound, and it treats character traits as moves. readers differ on how comfortable that is, and the legacy is more complicated than the book suggests. IMG grew into an organization that simultaneously represented athletes, owned and ran events, and sold the broadcast rights to them, a set of roles that attracted sustained criticism over conflicts of interest. None of that appears here. What survives is nonetheless substantial. The central argument was correct and has been absorbed so completely that its originality is now hard to see. The observational material on reading people is genuinely sharp, and the self-management chapters on saying no, on doing the hard thing first, and on the discipline of following up are as applicable now as they were then, which is more than most business books from the 1980s can claim. The reason this book lasted is not any single tactic. It is the observation in the title, made at a moment when nobody in a position of authority was saying it. The technical content of business, McCormack argued, is the part that can be taught in a classroom, tested and certified. That is precisely why it gets taught. The part that actually determines outcomes, whether you can read a room, whether people trust you, whether you know when to stop talking, and whether you do what you said you would do, is difficult to examine and therefore mostly ignored. That gap has narrowed since 1984, and it has not closed. It is still true that the person who reliably returns calls, listens properly, and knows when the sale is already made, will outperform a cleverer colleague who does none of those things. That was the summary of What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School by Mark McCormack. This narration is an original summary and commentary. It is not a substitute for the book, and if it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIIO Book Library. Thank you for listening.